Hi, everyone. I'm Cameron Munter, President and CEO of the East West Institute in New York City. I'd like to welcome you to another edition of EWI Podcast, where we explore some of today's most critical global issues with leading thinkers, influencers, and analysts. We encourage you to check out our previous podcasts available on our website, www.eastwest.ngo. Today, I'm pleased to be speaking with Dr. Irene Finell-Honigman, a professor of international finance and economic policy at Columbia's School of International and Public Affairs, known by its acronym CIPA. She's been lecturing on international banking as well as EU banking and policy at CIPA since 2001. Irene also served as a senior advisor on financial policy to the Clinton administration. She's also the author of two books, the first entitled A Cultural History of Finance, and the second, International Banking for a New Century. Many of our listeners may be familiar with her commentary on Bloomberg News, The Huffington Post, and NPR, discussing U.S.-EU relations and Brexit. Welcome, Irene.
Thank you.
We're delighted to have you with us, and let's dive into our topic, the EU. A lot of observers are claiming that the transatlantic relations are at a low point. Angela Merkel has publicly stated that Europeans can no longer rely on America. And while he doesn't speak for European leaders, Donald Tusk, the European Council president, has actually said that President Trump is a threat to Europe. So, I mean, there's a lot of rhetoric floating around. The U.S. has been without an ambassador to the European Union for over a year, the longest such gap. Donald Trump, in addition, supported Brexit, and 2 years into his presidency, he has yet to visit the U.K., our closest ally. So the question here is, how did we get to this point, and what do you think are the roots of this impaired relationship?
It's right now, I think, a very confusing relationship. And in that sense, because we are at a moment of such great insecurity, particularly considering all of the changes that are actually occurring in Europe on the structural level, on the actual political crisis level, with situations like Brexit, the fact that it is confusing adds an enormous level of tension and makes it more difficult to really know where the relationship is going.
So on this thing, we would say Donald Trump and these other kinds of questions are more an effect than a cause. There are deeper and other kinds of causes to the difficulties.
Correct.
Here.
And I think in a way, interestingly enough, from my own background, however, I'm willing to give the president a little bit of credit because he has actually, without any prior knowledge, without any background of the history or the very long political trajectory that the EU and the US have gone through together, and with absolutely no experience or experienced staff, unfortunately, he has entered the fray at the most challenging and difficult time. And this is exactly a period where ideally we would have the pillars in place, parties in place, structures in place, and he would then somehow be able to maneuver. That has not been the case. So we seem to have, I would say, a confluence of negative elements.
What would be some of these things you think ought to be in place, the pillars you've described or the mechanisms that in an ideal world would help to solve not only the internal issues in the EU, but the transatlantic ones?
Well, I just want to actually maybe give a little bit of a background where I see some of the real concerns now. We are in a completely different and in a way almost reversal situation from where we were between 2009 and 2014, when both in the US coming out of the financial crisis and then lurching, unfortunately, into the sovereign debt crisis in the European Union, we kept on going from economic instability to economic instability and concern. And yet, despite the sovereign debt crises, despite the forced bailouts, despite the push into austerity, the recession across the European Union, fundamentally, both in the US with its slow recovery and the EU, there was political stability. We knew basically where the leaders were coming from, what the overarching policies were, what the political parties were. And so, despite everything, those pillars were still in place. What has happened since roughly 2014, and particularly as a reaction to the extreme pressures pushed on Europe through the austerity programs and through the massive unemployment, that there has been a very major resurgence of right-wing, anti-EU, anti-euro, basically anti-certainly immigration, I'll talk about that in a moment, but a much more profound sense that the countries that were in a sense benefiting the most felt that the European Union had let them down. And what happened was that We had one tiny little red flag we sometimes forget. In 2014, in the European Union parliamentary elections, 27% of the actual candidates and the winners came actually out of right-wing parties and entered parliament. And this was sort of seen as a bad thing, but not that serious. Within a year, Angela Merkel, for the most extraordinarily noble reasons, opened up the border and basically instigated, provoked the migration crisis. The issue with the migration crisis was not that it was necessarily a wrong decision, but it never had a plan B. And she functioned on the assumption, and still the old assumption, that all countries would take a share and that all countries would equally feel responsible. And of course, that was not at all the case. That type of situation, in fact, instigated and exacerbated at its worst all of the negative tendencies in this anti-EU, anti-Euro movement. So we had this, I would say, as a cataclysm. And then within a short period, we hit June 2016 and we had Brexit. And on to Trump. Now, what is so interesting, however, is actually between 2014 and now, Europe is in economic recovery. Europe is no longer suffering the way it did. All countries back at the bond market, increase in consumer confidence, in growth, in investment flows. Banking has been restabilized through, in part, the IMF and the, of course, European Central Bank, European Banking Union. So we have so many elements that we would assume, according to any classic premise, once the economic situation improves, political stability will follow, will come back. And this has not occurred. And that's why now we are in this very odd situation of economically moving forward. Europe is no longer a basket case by far. And at the same time, politically, it's almost like every day, every month, every week, we run into some other major problem. Certainly now, having gone on the economic side from the southern periphery, our political issues now are on the east. So this is a very odd situation where what you, and that's perhaps going back to what you would assume should be a situation, and it's not.
Well, in this case, you have people who are the critics, the traditional critics of the EU, who, of course, didn't just invent themselves at the time of Brexit, didn't just invent themselves at the time of the Greek crisis, but people even back in the 1990s who were skeptical about the adaptation of a euro without a common fiscal policy or other critiques that came up about the euro. They weren't in power, but they were always there. And many of them would claim it was built into the system. Once you, you know, with the Lisbon Treaty and everything else, it's built into the system that it would have these problems. It's only a question of when. Do you buy into that idea that there were structural difficulties that would be masked until the financial crisis and the other crises you mentioned? Or is this something that really hit Europe and Europe has to cope with?
Well, I do agree with one thing that so many of us who have been involved with Europe for a long time, both on the financial and political side, have always said, and particularly in terms of the financial structure and the Eurozone, no one ever, not only no one ever thought of, but no one ever assumed a worst case scenario, ever. And this is a problem that there was always sort of a sense of rumblings that would eventually might come back to haunt them. And in fact, it's rather interesting because in 1999, when the IMF was being basically starting to restructure after the Asian currency crisis and all the mistakes that occurred, but very much also trying to formulate what would be its position in relation to various crises. And at one point, in fact, this was a discussion in Germany, in German parliament, what would happen if Europe, by any chance, were to need the IMF? And the response at the time was, that is so extraordinarily unlikely that we don't even have to bother. Did it make sense at the time? Yes. When you were looking at basically boom growth economies, very stable economies, everything seemed fine. Because of the massive amount of flows of investment, because of the overall growth during the period of roughly the 2003-2007, the assumption that in reality, a lot of countries we now know were not presenting any type of clear and accurate information, were in fact sort of hanger-ons, were still for far too long after the expansion of 2005, remained basically recipient countries rather than becoming responsible donor countries. And these are very important structures.
They are. And now you have, at least, a wounded and yet still standing Angela Merkel, and you have Macron. So you have the old traditional engine of EU change. Do you think that they and their advisors understand, or I don't want to sound as if, of course, they understand they're in the middle of this, but do they acknowledge what you have just said are some of the structural problems that preceded the crises? And if they do, what are they going to do about it?
Well, I think a certain number of steps have already been taken. By basically being forced in emergency circumstances to create all of these different bailout mechanisms, and basically the European Stability Pact, the budgetary pact, and very importantly, by providing to the European Central Bank, which originally had simply a monetary policy mandate, to take on a vast expansion of functions to basically become a Fed. And to basically become the supervisor, the monitor, and much more important, what I think every country realized, their own bank could not be their lender of last resort. And this is something that was not understood.
So they're getting there.
They are not only, I would say, getting there, but they have taken substantial steps. And there is now, I think, much more a sense that certain structures they may not avoid, but perhaps they can give the preventive signs or very early on. We are looking at a very deeply anchored and enormously difficult, and this is one of the issues with Brexit, enormously complex legal and administrative structure. You don't simply walk in one day and you walk out. In many ways, one of the problems, interestingly enough, however, was because there was never an exit clause to the European Union. You know, it was a little bit, comparison I always make, it was always Hotel California. You could check out any time, you could never leave. And that was actually a strength in many ways. So do I believe fundamentally that in one form or another, and it may have to require a lot of recalibration, and it may have to require, interestingly enough, returning to perhaps a model coming from the 1990s of what we called actually concentric circles, of different circles of leadership, importance, and in a sense, authority, coming again through the French-German partnership, bringing in all of the other original members despite all of the problems, and now Italy is a major issue. And at the same time, making it clear to all of these peripheral members that they are still very much part, but that there will be rules and regulations and criteria and conditions. The thing that is fascinating about the skeptics in relation to the European Union, even at the worst of the sovereign debt crises, we have to remember Croatia came into the EU, Estonia and Latvia joined the Eurozone. When actually asked, do you want to leave the EU? Everyone sort of stepped back, which is now the situation in Poland. And it's quite, in a way, shocking, because Poland, which is already, I'm afraid, the worst pupil at this point, and certainly has already been called under Article 7, potentially, of direct violation, but because it is also the recipient of massive subsidies, they do not want to leave. And we are now in a situation where so many countries, they do not want the European Union, Brussels, or God, Berlin, telling them what to do, but they certainly still want to have the benefits.
Isn't that, in a way, what people who voted for Brexit thought?
The Brexit situation, I think, is actually different. First of all, I think it's different because the UK and the EU always had a very unusual and interesting relationship. In many ways, the UK was always with the EU and not necessarily of it. And we can go back all the way to de Gaulle, who absolutely refused to have the British come in, till they finally do, and of course through Margaret Thatcher, who created these very important opt-out clauses, so that from 92 and then into the transition, we have to remember that the UK never gave up the Bank of England, never gave up pound sterling, never gave up complete economic, basically, independence, and in that sense was able to have its own business cycles, which worked enormously in its favor. It was necessarily hit by the recessionary pressures coming out of the sovereign debt crisis, but nowhere as badly as the other countries. So The other thing that is sort of the irony of the relationship with the UK is London is still the global center of euro-denominated transactions. So we are in a very odd situation where there definitely was this huge surge of sovereignty, of anti-immigration, in part, I would not even say so much led in the UK necessarily by xenophobia, but just sort of wanting to be an island again unto itself.
Could the process of Brexit, ironically, be part of that reform that will make the EU a more functional place?
I think there is a possibility. Interestingly enough, because Brexit is turning out to be such an amazing muddle, and also it will have far longer duration in the sense of, with this transition agreement, we already are looking 21 months, and then X number more months in terms of implementation, and all of the complexities. I think every other country that might even vaguely have thought of it as a solution is beginning to realize that it's basically a non-solution. So that is one certain positive.
One salutary thing. People have a much more realistic notion that this is what happens when you try to leave.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is very important. The other element is, yes, I think a sense of sort of solidarity with the principles of the European Union and the need to function as this extraordinarily broad and, despite everything, enormously wealthy global entity, and an understanding, and even for a country as wealthy and historically prominent as the UK, what are the risks when you suddenly try to go it alone? And that, in a way, is certainly a cohesive force. One of the things that has been a problem for years has been the incredible bureaucratic morass in Brussels. Will that begin to really undergo genuine reforms? Will there be an understanding, not only is what happened in 2007 with the Lisbon Constitution, but really integrating an entire different number of elements into a broader accords that will really allow Europe to function in a much clearer, simpler, and more efficient way?
Well, one of the problems that gets described often is that Brussels, instead of choosing to take political power, which in a way it's not allowed to, it chooses to solve problems by bureaucratic and administrative means. And some problems are not easily solved by bureaucratic administrative means. And so I wonder, you raise the US-EU relationship. What do you see coming out of that? If Brussels is still evolving, that is to say, if what you called the bureaucratic morass and all that is not really strong in a politically decisive way, and the constituent members are divided, what will happen, for example, on these tariff issues? In this first case, the steel and aluminum tariffs, the allies were exempted. But what if further trade issues come up?
I think in a lot of ways, yes. And the reason I think so is that, again, if we go back in history, we have to remember that the European Union has gone through multiple crises and multiple transmutations, and has developed in part organically and sometimes in part due to crises over basically 50 years. We are now in a situation where there is very much consciousness, and unfortunately, if I may just digress for a moment, this was where Trump's first encounter with the European Union in not immediately making it clear that the US was honoring all NATO commitments right away started on the wrong note. Because it was so important, as the pressures are coming from Russia, as the pressures are coming, and I very much agree with Robert Kaplan's theory, we're coming back to a far more imperialistic sort of geopolitical framework, and where you have these huge external forces, and how does Europe deal with them, not country by country, but as the European Union? What was needed at that point for the US to immediately make it clear, whatever has been established is established, none of this is going anywhere, now let's move forward? That was not the case.
Interesting point here is that I recall when, in the more confident years, say between 2000 and 2007, when I was a diplomat, we would work with the Europeans, and they would think of European impact, EU impact on, say, the Mediterranean strategy or the Eastern strategy. It was Europe's impact on these other places. Now, there's also a kind of a cultural shift where those places have an impact on Europe. We're scared of what the Russians are bringing to us. We're scared that migrants and other problems come from the South. So in addition to the structural changes that are necessary, what about the psychological changes? How do you I mean, it's trickier ground, this is, but how do you measure Europe's confidence? And can Europe become confident the way that I remember under Barroso and others that they seemed to be?
Well, I think this is actually an extremely important issue. Europe was not only an economic project, it never was. Europe, in fact, was what I always called a psycho-historical and a political project that then brought along an economic dimension. And that was also part of a generation. And I think that is another element we have to bear in mind. We are now basically two generations after the founding fathers who came out of World War II and who totally understood, not only intellectually, but on the most profound visceral level, why they were creating the European Union. That, in a way, is one of the challenges. And interestingly enough, Angela Merkel and Macron feel that, and they do understand that. And I think despite what we hear, all the bizarre soap opera out of Italy and so many other things, on a much more deep level, there still is that sense that what Europe meant, why we did it to begin with. And the tragedy of some of these extreme right-wing movements is this brings out the monsters of history. And oddly enough, perhaps by doing so, it reminds people of what had been conquered, and what had been sublimated. That perhaps is a much, much more profound message as to the identity of all of us, if we're Europeans, of why, personally, I still believe in the strength of the European Union.
Well, that's a very important point. You know, I remember a very famous statement. It was Milan Kundera who wrote a piece in the New York Review of Books, must have been in the 1980s, where he described the freedom fighters in Hungary in 1956 in the television or radio tower as the Russian tanks close in on them. We die for Europe.
Yes.
Right? They're dying for Europe. And what you're saying is this idea of Europe is something not to be trifled with, despite the fact that many of the older, more idealistic, second generation, let's call them, people are maybe passing from the scene, that idea of Europe is not dead, you would say.
I would definitely say that. I think now, however, what will have to really be thought through, we no longer have clear definitions of what was the right, what was the left, and what were the old classic liberal versus socialist democratic versus non-democratic factions. And I think in a way it's a bit of a shame almost, because sometimes one senses that President Trump wishes we were back in 1984 and had very clear enemies. We don't. And that can be remarkably confusing, that our economic allies can be actually our political foes or vice versa. And this is where, in a way, Macron is probably now in very seminal figure in having cut through, first time since 1958, the traditional political parties, creating a new party with En Marche and then La République En Marche, and basically saying exactly this point. We can take the elements from the right, from the left. We can keep our values, our heart, our history intact, but we now have to move it into another configuration.
And another configuration involves things even beyond America, Britain, and the constituent members. You've got, for example, the agreement with Iran. I'd love to hear what you think might happen. And then in broader sense, the rise of China and the EU relation with China. So two quick questions. What do you think will happen should the Americans decide to back away from the JCPOA, the Iranian agreement? What impact would that have in Europe and perhaps on European-American relations as well as Iran? And what do you make of the rise of China, the economic power of China, which, of course, was not so much on the horizon in that generation or two or three that formed the EU, but is something we all have to deal with. So Iran and China, what do you think?
I think right now it looks again that time may be the Iranian deal's best friend, in the sense that this may just sort of drag out. This again seems to be, certainly from the American side, very poorly thought out, not at all clear. The Europeans have a set position in wanting to maintain the status quo, but they do not seem to be that rigid. There may be some flexibility there to discuss.
And by flexibility, it would be they would actually be willing to, what was the idea, fix or nix? They might be willing to fix the agreement?
I think they might be more willing. Europeans in general, and if we just think of how they responded to all of these crises, tend to want to fix. And even what we see now with Brexit, We're looking for a fix. We're no longer even talking really about a hard Brexit. This has already moved off the stage. So there is this overall mindset. I think the situation with China is far more long-term and far more complex, and has probably become even more complicated in the last month once President Xi officially declared himself basically president for life. So then we go back, like Russia, like with China, like with Turkey, with much more imperialistic mindsets. We're looking more at long-term strategy coming out of countries which are either emerging as economic powers or are not economic powers, and yet have enormous political clout. Each of these cases, the European Union is going to have to maneuver around each of these cases very, very, very carefully. And I would say not at all, and perhaps again, the US is sometimes naive looking for a one-size-fits-all. This is not a one-size-fits-all. The situation with Russia, we're still back on oil gas dependency. We can't get away from that. And Merkel has been brilliant in understanding that and maneuvering. And yet at the same time, we went full cyber warfare. So how do we play on these different registers?
You mentioned, though, this interesting thing, and maybe we can talk in a global sense to kind of finish up. You talked about the imperial rivalries, and if we look at the five imperial points that exist now in some way, a traditional America that is now looking at itself, in describing itself, even McMaster and others describing America as not so much facing terrorism as its main problem, but great power rivalry. The Russians and the Chinese clearly comfortable with this kind of idea, the emerging Indian idea. And then if the fifth point is the European Union, out of those five, there's only one that is what I would call a post-Westphalian state or agglomerate, and that's Europe. That is to say, you've got America, Russia, China, India, that can see themselves as units and are in that sense traditionally more coherent, and Europe, which many of us, myself included, saw as the new wave of a different kind of approaches to sovereignty. Does that mean that in this great power rivalry, Europe has an undeniable disadvantage, that it's not a traditional unitary state?
I'm not sure, because in many ways, maybe returning back to the situation of the 70s and 80s, where Europe, even as it was slowly forming and slowly coming together through the Treaty of Rome into the 1980s and then into the European Union, as actually the buffer and the, in a sense, sort of intermediary and of extraordinary importance between the other great powers.
Or we could say among.
Among and between.
Yes.
And we, after all, when the United States came in with the Marshall Plan, the whole concept was build up Europe to protect, in a sense, and to be that power between the Soviet Union and America. Are we perhaps returning to that? And at this point, with a Europe that is far, far more sophisticated in understanding how it can work as a cohesive unit, far more united at the end of the day in terms of its goals in relation both to Russia, and now beginning to understand how to navigate what is going on in the US. And in reality, unlike where it was in the 70s or even the 80s, a world global economic power. So with all of these factors, Europe may still have a very important role to play.
Not so much that it can compete with the traditional kind of unitary powers, but precisely because it's not like the other powers.
Exactly.
It plays a special role.
And also because, interestingly enough, it is at this point, I would say, despite all of the problems, in many ways perhaps the most representative of exactly what you mentioned, certainly the post-Bretton Woods democratic principles.
Well, it's a very interesting idea and an optimistic one, which I guess you would say the initiative here lies in the hands of Macron and Merkel to make that happen, to make it effective as well as symbolically attractive.
That is correct. I think there is going to have to be a great deal of care that we don't see not only resurgence, but we don't see predominance of extremist movements. That ideally there's already a little bit beginning a way to a little mitigate some of the impact of the migration crises and absorption and understanding this cannot happen again. Hopefully, under these circumstances, if the economic conditions continue to move forward, we can begin to see exactly Europe understand how it can take a larger role, fully conscious of the dangers, fully conscious of where the risks are, but also fully conscious of the weight that it can still carry.
So this is a pleasingly optimistic take, which I like to hear about Europe at a time when many people are looking at gloom and doom. Maybe a final word, where do you see the US and the EU going?
I think, again, there's going to be probably a lot of bluster, a lot of vaguely positive, negative rhetoric. Right now, interesting left personalities do matter. And this is not the first time these issues have come up. President Obama did not have an ideal relationship with a lot of European leaders either. There's a long history. The best times were, in fact, the Reagan, Bush, and then the Thatcher, Mitterrand, Kohl. That is no longer. So right now, we have President Trump, who seems to have a rather confusing trying to avoid Merkel as much as possible. He seems not very comfortable with May. However, he's really, really likes Macron, which is enormously funny. But at the same time, he does tell us very often, I like Emmanuel. This puts an interesting level of weight and of pressure a little bit on Emmanuel Macron, who has so far done a brilliant job of understanding how to manage Trump. The real issue and the big test, interestingly enough, will be the climate, the Paris Climate Accord. Will Macron be able, if not necessarily to have Trump lose face and come back, but to somehow not declare himself 100% against? That would be, I think, a very positive first step. Thought showing that he understands he has to work somehow with the Europeans and giving Macron a lot of, in a sense, extra positives in his side as what he is able to accomplish. He seems to be the only one. Clearly, unfortunately, Italy is now not in the picture and smaller countries do not seem to interest Trump. But here, there is a certain line. So the best now we can hope for is a little bit more mutual respect. The whole nonsense with the tariffs has to settle down. But we also need to find some way, and as you mentioned, ambassadors have to be put in place. This is the burden of the US right now. You know, get some sort of system in place, get some sort of interlocutors so you can continue the conversation. We don't know. If that does not happen, I think then it'll just sort of be a kind of odd status quo, not particularly that negative, but unfortunately not positive.
Well, I'll finish then with a great image that I think of as you talk, which is the last scene of Casablanca, where at the end, Rick goes to Captain Renault and says, this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Exactly.
And the Americans and the French are back at it, bringing history to a nice close.
In some way,
That's what we're looking for. Now, we may lose Ingrid Bergman, but that's another question. So, Iran, thank you so much for sharing your expertise and insight with us here at EWI Podcast. That was Dr. Irene Fienel-Honigman, Professor of International Finance and Economic Policy at Columbia's School of International and Public Affairs. Please remember to look for us on our website, SoundCloud, and other online platforms, all under the name of East-West Institute. Thank you for listening.